Welcome again to another edition of the IDS Hour. I'm Paul Honeycutt, joined as always by Jeff Wilker, Director of In-Depth Studies. As promised last time, we are starting a new book, a rather interesting book. It's entitled From the Finger of God. It's written by a fellow named Philip Ross, who neither of us know much about. He's from Scotland. But the premise of the book is the subtitle, The Biblical and Theological Basis for the Threefold Division of the Law. Sounds pretty important, but let's kind of break that down a little bit. When he says the law, what law is he talking about? And what is the threefold, what are the three divisions that he's talking about?
Which, what we want to do is to make sure we understand the purpose of the book. And of course, the law is the Mosaic law, and the threefold division, moral, civil, ceremonial. There's three different categories of law under the Mosaic law. And the reason Ross wants to... is doing this book is to defend the idea of covenant theology, that the Mosaic law is the foundational giving of all law, and in some sense it continues on to today. And the way they can legitimize or justify that it continues on to today is that if you divide the Mosaic law into moral, civil, ceremonial, the civil and ceremonial obviously don't continue today. No one would dispute that. The moral does. And, of course, then they would equate the Ten Commandments primarily with the moral law.
Okay.
And that's the basic premise. So if he can show, which is going to make the case first from church history, that everybody has embraced this threefold division of the Mosaic law, therefore, in his mind, that goes a long way to justify his position, that therefore his idea of the Mosaic law as the foundational giving of the law and the Ten Commandments as the most basic summary of the requirements of that law that continue for all time, the moral law.
This is maybe a stupid question, but within the giving of the law, whether we're talking about Leviticus or Deuteronomy, the re-giving of the law, is it given in that manner? Is it specifically set out in three distinct categories?
Oh, no, that's the whole problem, is that I guess before even we get to that, let's just sort of address his, we can turn to Leviticus 19, but the point that we would, of course, we don't agree with him. We're coming from a New Covenant theology perspective where our point is that even if there is this distinct threefold division of the Mosaic law, that's irrelevant because from a New Covenant theology point of view, we would say from a biblical point of view, that the New Testament only views it as one law, and that one Mosaic law comes to an end the cross at the end of the Old Covenant era, that we're under a new version of God's law, the law of Christ. And so the divisions are irrelevant to us, even if they exist. Mm. They're irrelevant.
Well, let me ask this, and I don't mean to be sarcastic or anything like that, but if that being the case, and I would agree with you, why are we going to spend the time to go through this book? What's the benefit to doing this?
Well, the benefit of doing this seems to be based on the fact that this book seems to be the most definitive or full attempt to justify the idea of covenant theology, that the Mosaic law has been there from the very beginning. That in effect, when you get to Mount Sinai, in many respects, it's just a restating.
Mm-hmm.
The Ten Commandments were there in the Garden of Eden.
Mm.
And the whole concept of of moral law is established. That is, there is a body of law that transcends all time periods. And once we identify what that law is, and the Ten Commandments is the most primary thing to help us identify what that law is, then we know this is the law that is the basis of, in effect, all other law.
Mm.
So this is an apologetic for the view of covenant theology on law. That is, that the Ten Commandments are the essence of all law. They were there in the garden, Garden of Eden. And of course, with we will address this as we progress through the book, New Covenant theology would say, no, the Ten Commandments are the summary of the requirements of the Old Covenant. Mm. And they were, and so we need to address that.
Right.
Address that issue as we go through this.
So by understanding their argument, his argument, and apologetic for their view, we will get a better understanding of what covenant theology really is based upon. So that when I'm listening to my next White Horse in CD that I get, I'll have a better understanding when these guys start talking about law and gospel and all that kind of stuff. I'll figure it out. The whole covenant of works, all that stuff will be fleshed out as we go through this book.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
So for that reason, the book is probably very worthwhile to go through.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you and I have both expressed at least initial frustration mm-hmm. as we've begun to go through it. We're, you know, partway through the opening couple of chapters as to how, you know, Philip Ross, you know, his approach mm-hmm. that we struggle with. But right. that will all come out in due time.
Okay. So back to Leviticus 19.
Yeah, Leviticus 19. And here is just, this is a classic illustration. Leviticus 19, now I'm reading from the NIV, and they give this subtitle to chapter 19, Various Laws. Because it's sort of a potpourri. And just to give you an example, that you get verse 4, verse 3 says, each of you must respect his mother and father, and you must observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Well, that's pretty important stuff. Everybody would agree. And then verse 4 says, do not turn to idols or make gods of cast metal for yourselves. I am the Lord your God. Mm-hmm. Everybody would agree with that. Then you get down to verse 9. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time to pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. Well, that seems to be, you know, not quite on the same par. Mm-hmm. Then the next verse says, do not steal, do not lie, do not deceive any one another. Well, that's pretty serious stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're going down, and then you get down to verse 19, where it says, keep my decrees. Do not mate different kinds of animals. Do not plant your field with two kinds of seed. Do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that seems, you know, not really earth-shattering. And then it talks about, you know, sleeping with another person. If a man sleeps with a woman who is, you know, a slave girl promised to another man, what must be done? It just seems to go back and forth through the entire chapter of issues of sins that we would say are serious versus sins that we would tend to say, well, you know, don't seem to be so serious. But the bottom line is, Leviticus 19 seems to take into account all kinds of laws.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real neat division. It's just various laws. And the NIV's title seems to be quite accurate. Mm-hmm. Just various laws. And so now we recognize that in the Torah, so especially we're talking Exodus to Deuteronomy, when laws are given, there's sections where they talk about all the feasts.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the Mosaic Law. There's sections they talk about sacrifices. We got that. There's sections that talk about tithing and Sabbath and all that stuff. So we know that they sort of go topically through things. But the problem is, do the biblical authors, or Moses here is the author of the Torah, at least he's the one who gathered the material together, however you view that, was his intent to teach you that there are clearly three distinct categories of Mosaic law that are clearly easy to distinguish? And I would say no. That's the whole problem. It just seems to be mushed together.
Well, and it's interesting because looking at page 1, chapter 1, actually it is page 1, chapter entitled A Catholic Doctrine, he makes a couple statements here which I think right away we would stop and go, wait a second. He says, doctrine divides, or so they say, but this book is about a doctrine that has united Christians in every century and across denominations. He goes down further. He says that it is well known and adopted by the ancients, says Calvin. Most Reformed confessions likewise adopt the division, and even those that do not declare it work within its framework. So he's trying to make this sort of, in the world of sales, you call it an assumed close, that everybody holds to this. Everybody believes this. Yet what you just said, Scripture doesn't say this. There is no biblical, Old Testament, Old Covenant, strict demarcation of these threefold divisions within the law. Yet he's saying that doctrinally it's existed from ancient times.
Now, what because this whole first chapter, entitled Chapter 1, The Catholic Doctrine, what he's doing, he's going back into church history to get all these testimonies of guys about how they viewed the Mosaic Law as far as its divisions. Now, we would agree that, you know, the people that he quotes view there to be some sort of subject divisions in Mosaic Law. The problem is that we both recognize is that the guys he quotes don't necessarily agree on the same divisions.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, and it's as though Philip Ross, when his criterion for choosing their quotes was that they saw divisions. But the point is, if they weren't seeing the same divisions, that causes a big problem, which all goes to, at least it seems to say to me, as well as my own Bible reading of, you know, Exodus through Deuteronomy, is that it isn't clear. Mm-hmm. It isn't clear. We all recognize that some things seem to be more important than other things. Got that. But that doesn't change the fact that in the giving of it, there is no clear distinction. So then you have to ask the question, why is this such a big deal? Because within the scheme of covenant theology, it is crucial that there be a distinct threefold division of the law into moral, civil, ceremonial kinds of laws, because this is necessary to justify their idea of what is the purpose of the Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, for us today.
Yeah, am I still bound by that law? And he says on page 2, the very last sentence of the first paragraph, one part of the law is non-binding, he's talking about to Christians, another binding in its underlying principles, and another ever-binding.
Right.
So that's his premise going into this book and into this first chapter. And as you said, and it is fascinating, as I'm reading these various examples and quotes from a number of people all across church history, both current and past, they all seem to say something different. None of them agree. One fellow here, it's a fellow named Jason Meyer, bottom of page 8 and top of page 9, in a book titled The End of the Law, he writes these words, "The New Testament itself does not make these three distinctions, and no one living under the law of Moses seriously thought that they could pick which parts were binding and which were optional." So right away, he's disagreeing. He quotes Tom Wells, who we know, who's written a co-author of a book on New Covenant theology. Says the same thing. He says, as evidence for the wider sweeping conclusion that everything moral is comprehended in one of these Ten Commandments, both the larger and smaller catechism offer just three verses. This is surely much too narrow a base from which to draw such a comprehensive conclusion. Further than that, assuming that Matthew 19 contains the best evidence for this opinion, we must note that it was not available to Old Testament believers at all. So there seems to be quite a bit of disagreement within these circles as to, you know, the threefold division to begin with and its application to us today.
I mean, we can commend Philip Ross for being sort of honest in his collecting up of quotes from church history regarding how you view the Mosaic Law. He just does, and he faithfully records, you know, exactly what they say. Mm-hmm. We would say, even though they seem to undermine his very argument. Mm-hmm. Now, an issue that is brought up, which there's probably three different issues that at least right off the bat we need to address, is the issue of principle versus law. Then we need to talk about the Ten Commandments to some degree. I know we'll talk about them more as we progress through the book.
Right.
And then we need to talk about the Sabbath.
Yes.
Because this is a big deal for Ross, as he the linchpin of the argument as far as how we view biblical law seems to revolve around the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So first let's go back to this issue of principle. And my response to that would be you are creating a category of principle. It's not law, but it's principle. And principle is binding. It's sort of like, we can use the Sabbath for an example, even though we're not going to look at it in detail at this moment. Okay, so Sabbath for Israel was Friday night, Saturday night. Okay, so you have people today saying, well, that's part of the Mosaic law, we're not under that. But the 1 in 7 principle still stands.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take one day off. Well, there is, as though there's no law about that today, but somehow the principle acts as sort of a law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that there is no verse that says that. So it's a make-believe category. What we would say would be that whatever period of time you lived in, you had to obey the laws as they were given. And we recognize that laws change. Particularly, we're talking in terms of from the Old Covenant era to the New Covenant era, meaning from the Mosaic law to the law of Christ. They change. And we have no problem saying, okay, there was a bunch of laws in the Mosaic law that are brought over in the law of Christ. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't obey them because they came from Mosaic law. We obey them because they're under the law of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
The only relevant question is this biblical law for me today?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only relevant question. The fact that it was law in a previous era is irrelevant. And there's no such thing as principle. So what they've tried to make the case to say is that because a law still was in effect, in some sense reflects a previous law, that the reason we obey it is because we're obeying the principle, not the details of the previous law, but the principle. And that's not the biblical argument. It's only if there's a law today, regardless of how it reflected a previous law, we obey it because the law says we obey it today. That's it. End of discussion. So there's no category of principle.
Mm-hmm.
It's either law or it's not law. Because we know 1 John 3:4, sin is breaking God's law.
Right.
Very clear.
Principle.
Yeah, breaking his principle. So if we can show it's law, then we break it, we sin.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the way it is.
So when we ask the question, as he does on that very first paragraph, am I still bound to obey the Mosaic law? That's an important question because we do, like you said in 1 John, breaking of God's law is sin. Well, I better know what that law is. I better know what it is I'm not supposed to break. So that becomes a very important question, doesn't it?
Right. So let's right off the bat, I mean, at least address this in a preliminary fashion. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, because as we work through the book, we are going to touch on all the relevant passages to this discussion. And here in 1 Corinthians 9, the Apostle Paul is talking about his evangelistic strategy, how he deals with the unbelievers. And he's talking about Jews and Gentiles. And he's sharing his faith, which that's what Paul does. And so he makes the point, and let's walk it through, begins at verse 1 Corinthians 9:19-21. He says, though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. Now what he means is that, okay, when I'm sharing my faith with a Jewish person, they think that the dietary laws of the Mosaic law is still in effect. So they're not going to eat pork. Well, so that means in the New Covenant era, I'm free to eat pork. But I'm not going to take them to the barbecue place where there's pork all the way around because that's so offensive to them, I wouldn't have a chance to give the gospel.
Right.
So I'll limit my freedom, though I'm not bound by that law. I will limit that freedom in order to share the gospel. I'll just refrain from going to a place that sells pork. Okay, that's really pretty straightforward. And then he says the same thing again. To those under the law, meaning Mosaic law, I became like one under the law. But then he says, though I myself am not under the law. This is a powerful statement, meaning the Mosaic law as a unit is no longer applicable to the Apostle Paul. He is not, that is no longer law for him. But then he goes on to say, to those not having the law, that's the Gentiles, I became like one not having the law. But then stop for a moment, and he says, so when I go share my faith with a Gentile person, it doesn't matter food-wise where we go, because that there are the law in which I am currently under, there are no dietary restrictions. Because he says, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. So when he makes the case to the Gentiles, I have this freedom to meet with you. He goes, don't get the idea that I am without law, that I don't believe there's still law for today. Of course I do. I'm just under Christ's law, a different version of law than the Jews were under during the Old Covenant era, the Mosaic law. So here, and this is something as we go through Philip Ross's book, we want to be sensitive as we go through it chapter by chapter. Is he going to address passages mm-hmm. like this? Mm-hmm. Which from our point of view would clearly say to us that Apostle Paul is saying by with divine authority that the Mosaic law as a unit is gone. So Paul is now under a different version of law, in some sense is very similar to the Mosaic law, but in other senses distinctly different. But that's irrelevant. The issue is he's just not under that version of God's law. Mm-hmm. He's under a different version. And, of course, if what we're saying is true, then, of course, the premises of Philip Ross's book is false. That is, just because you can show, in this first chapter, just because you can show that some people, some believers in time past, thought there were some sorts of different categories, divisions of Mosaic law, it's irrelevant, because when you look at it from the point of view of this side of Pentecost in the teaching passages, the whole Mosaic law is viewed as one law, and it's done with. It's no longer applicable to us today.
Yeah, and you were going to talk about, a little bit ago, you mentioned the Sabbath. On page 6, he makes this statement, and we were talking about this a little bit ago. He says, strike out the Sabbath, and you also shatter the entire category of moral law and all that depends on it. What does he mean by that?
Well, we would agree with him that that how you view the Sabbath is a really important deal. Mm-hmm. Of course, they view the Sabbath as, of course, the fourth commandment of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And they would say the Sabbath was there in the Garden of Eden. It was established in Genesis, the end of Genesis 2, where God, you know, rested on the mm-hmm. seventh day, and he declared it to be holy. Okay. And so if we can show that the law to obey, that the Sabbath law, whatever that was not uniform from the beginning until now, then this, because the Sabbath is viewed as the most basic of all moral laws. And remember this category, which we will address down the road more, this category of moral law, that is these special category of laws that transcend all periods of time, that are there from the very beginning, and these are the ones we want to identify. And the Ten Commandments are the vehicle to identify these.
Right.
But if we say, if we find out from Scripture that the Sabbath commandment, the fourth commandment, is not timeless, we are then saying that the whole basis of this moral law thing is gone. Mm. So even for now, let's examine that just in a preliminary fashion. And remember, I quoted just a little bit from Genesis 2. Just refresh our minds and just read through the actual quote. Genesis 2, 2 and 3. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Okay, so we clearly see that seventh day, God makes it holy, and because it's commemorating, he's finished his work of creating. That's all it says. Now, we'd have to ask the question, so we agree that this, at this point, before, you know, in the garden, that this seventh day was special. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, according to the fourth commandment in the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, which is recited in Exodus 20 and then repeated in Deuteronomy 5, there is laws attached to it. You're not allowed to do any work. That is the seventh commandment. On that day, the seventh day, which is actually Friday night to Saturday night, mm-hmm. in Israel, you cannot do any work. And there's a few exceptions. They talk about those, but in general, that's the point. Don't work. Okay? Well, the problem is that here in Genesis 2, there's no mention of any commandments not to work. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. Fact is, the first time we discover that particular laws are attached to the Sabbath day, the seventh day, is in Exodus 16, which we would say is the beginning of the Mosaic Law, where they're talking in terms of manna, collecting of manna, and where you're told that on the sixth day, he's going to give you, you collect up twice as much manna, because you don't collect it up on the seventh day, you must not work. Mm-hmm. Well, the point is there is, this is the first time law is mentioned with regard to the Sabbath. First time.
Yeah, because it's interesting, in that same Genesis chapter 2, verse 15 says, the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And the Lord God commanded the man, you're free to eat, and goes on.
Yeah.
There's nothing about 6 days.
No.
Take a day off. There is no mention at all.
No, there isn't. And so then you have to say, okay, does the very fact that it mentions the seventh day as a special day commemorating God resting from his work of creation, can we then read into that, well, that must mean that the laws regarding not working apply to this? Mm-hmm. No, because they're never mentioned.
That would be that principle idea you're talking
about.
Yeah,
and so let's say if we're a young earth people, which you and I are, but let's just say we are, that's the earth, let's say the earth is created, for argument's sake, 6,000 years ago. So Genesis 2 is 6,000 years ago. We all recognize generally that the Exodus, Moses led Israel out of Egypt, approximately 1400 BC. So that's, you're talking about approximately 4,500 years, 4,500 years later, we have Exodus 16 around there. Mm-hmm. So there is no, now from Genesis 2:2 until Exodus 16, there is no mention of any Sabbath keeping, laws about Sabbath, which is do not work. Not one verse.
That's a lot of Saturdays.
That is a lot of Saturdays. And so then, of course, the covenant guys, who are good guys, but the covenant guys will say, no, it's just assumed. Mm-hmm. And we would say, no, you say that because that neatly fits into your theory. But the facts, if we just took them at face value, do not fit into your theory. Because what they say is laws concerning not doing something or doing something on the seventh day don't come about until the Mosaic Law. Mm-hmm. Up until then, when the seventh day hit, you just remembered, oh, this is the day God finishes work of creating. Mm-hmm. That's all you knew. But now with Mount Sinai, Exodus 20, you have now the Ten Commandments given and the Fourth Commandment. The Sabbath is specific. There's laws given what you cannot do on that day.
Well, and that I think is for both of us as we kind of wrap this up, that the first chapter was somewhat frustrating. It was interesting, but frustrating, because he tends to just assume.
Yes.
That everybody buys into this, that this is the way it is, that this is how it is. And then it's striking, as we mentioned, that then he offers so many quotes and other people's views that contradict the very thing that he's trying to put forward. And you're just left kind of scratching your head and puzzling. That's why this next chapter, chapter two, we actually get into what did Moses write and what did Moses say, so to speak, and think and believe. We'll begin to really delve more into specifically the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, and look at how he views that and how he ultimately is going to make the argument to carry that forward into the New Covenant era. So, as always, if you have questions, feel free to give us a call. The phone number is
480-924-4290. By the way, you can Skype me. It's Jeff Volker with no break in the between the Jeff and the Volker. That's my Skype name, but I'm easy to find. You know, the email address, jeff.volker@ids.org. If you type that in to add a contact, you'll come to me, and I would, I interact via Skype, either audio or video, all around the world. So that's a free way to do it. Otherwise, I can call you. That's not a problem, and we're just glad to interact.
Yeah. We'll see you next week.